Well, thank you, Dr. Guy. I'd like to begin with a question today, brethren. The question is this: in the Bible, who might be characterized as the greatest manager or administrator? Greatest manager or administrator. Who might you put in that role? You might have several people in mind. Let me set this here. There we go. Maybe I can narrow it down by asking it this way. Who in the Bible was the greatest godly manager or administrator? That'd be one way to think. Maybe we could narrow it down even further by asking in the Bible, who was the greatest godly manager or administrator who overcame the greatest number of obstacles, the greatest severity of obstacles? Now, people who deal with the Bible often think, well, the answer to all those questions, no matter who's the greatest or whatever, is always Jesus. Yeah, but not really. We can always say, well, he was God in the flesh. Of course, he's greatest everything. But that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is who in the Bible is recorded as having been a manager, an administrator. And again, you might think of one particular person. At least I hope my questions have brought you down. Could you mouth the words without saying it out loud? Who do you think is the greatest administrator in the Bible? Wow. Very well. Everybody came to the right... Okay, end of the sermon. Good. No, there's more than that. Joseph probably could be considered the greatest manager or administrator ever recorded in the Bible. And who knows, maybe one of the greatest administrators of all time. We don't know, but quite an amazing individual. By the end of his life, Joseph had organized collection of food and storage of millions of bushels of wheat. Millions of bushels. He became responsible for land acquisitions totaling in the millions of acres. Current day Egypt has about 247 million acres. During the time of Joseph, Egypt was actually a much larger area. It extended far down the Nile, further than it does today. So we're talking hundreds of thousands, if not millions of acres, that Joseph became responsible to administer. He actually acquired this, all this land for Pharaoh, systematically, acre by acre. He gathered millions of acres, to the point that time after Joseph, in essence, Pharaoh owned the whole country. And he leased it back to individuals. Fascinating history in that regard. He was responsible for food distribution to millions of people. An organized system that would actually provide food for millions of starving people. Not just people from his country, but also those who would travel in to purchase food because of the famine in their areas. An amazing, spectacularly talented individual. Now, it's interesting that the stories in the Bible, as you know, are there for our edification, for our instruction. So what we're going to do today is take a look at a portion of the life of Joseph, this able administrator, to watch his life develop a bit and to see what we might be able to gain as a result of God including this story in the Scriptures for us. If you're like me, administering a million anything seems incredibly intimidating. But to think that you would soon be responsible for feeding the population of Egypt at the time of Joseph is estimated to be at least 3 million people. The cities of Thebes and Memphis and places like that probably had 100,000 plus citizens in each of those cities. So the high estimates are up to 10 million people. And after 7 years of famine, as you know, those people would have been starving, because they did not prepare the way Joseph was inspired to prepare. So when you think of that administrative ability, quite a talented individual. Let's watch it develop, see what we learn from it along the way. Let's turn to Genesis chapter 37, where we might say the adult story of Joseph begins. Now, when we say adult, Joseph was at this point 17 years old. But in that society, that was considered an adult. He was not just a teenager. Teenager is a fairly recent moniker that's been added to separate things in our culture, but that wasn't known back then. It was kid and it was adult. There wasn't much in between. You came to age at age 13 and then you were an adult from that time forward. So in this case, Joseph was what we would call today a young adult. The parallel today might be a young man in his late 20s or early 30s. As far as their level of maturity and their level of responsibility. So in this case, Joseph, we open the door and Joseph is already administering his father's flocks, which would have been considerable at this point based on the history up to this time. Let's take a look here at Genesis chapter 37 and verse 1. Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger. They, in essence, were a nomadic tribe. Land was not quite considered the same kind of ownership that we have today. So these Bedouin kind of families could stay in the area, graze their flocks on this open pasture, similar to what you might think of as open range out west in America here. We still have some areas like that, millions of acres that are just open range. You put your cattle out there, your sheep out there, and they can graze wherever they want. As long as you pick them up at the end of the time and don't just leave them all go. So similar to that. Joseph in verse, and then it says this is the history of Jacob. Rest of verse 1. Joseph being 17 years old was feeding the flock with his brothers. And when we think of feeding the flock, we're not just talking about casting out grain. This was grazing. In other words, he was responsible for the grazing areas for all these flocks. And again, we're talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of sheep that Jacob actually owned by this time. When you look at Jacob's history, he was quite a wealthy individual with very large flocks. And it says, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. Now we'll pause there for a moment and we'll add what I think might be the very first lesson that we can learn as we look at the life of Joseph. Something he would learn to do, I'm sure, much better as he grew. But the first principle I've jotted down is that we can benefit. Learn to correct with wisdom. Learn to correct with wisdom. Joseph had responsibility. Now, when we look at this, it says we don't, well, we're not told a lot of background. What we are told is that apparently Joseph had responsibility. We don't know if he was actually asked to oversee the situation, but it seems so. Because it doesn't say Dan or Naphtali or Gad or Asher were sent to feed the flocks. It was Joseph. So clearly Joseph's the one in responsibility. Now, when it says the children of Bilhah and Zilpah, remember who Bilhah and Zilpah were? It says they were Jacob's wives, but they were kind of second-class wives, if we could put it that way. You might remember that Bilhah was given to Rachel by her father Laban as a slave, a household slave, to attend to Rachel. And Zilpah, on the other hand, was given by Laban to the sister Leah to be her household slave. Jacob ends up marrying both of these women as well as the two sisters, Rachel and Leah. So he has four wives, two of them kind of legitimate wives, really only one legitimate wife. We'll see that in a few minutes. And these two concubines or slaves or wives that were slaves providing children as well. So each of these two ladies had two children. Zilpah had Gad and Asher. Bilhah had Dan and Naphtali. So there he was, Joseph, with his four older brothers. All four of these brothers were older. Why were none of them put in charge? Well, apparently, as Jacob looked forward to who would care for his inheritance, Joseph was the one who was selected. Why Joseph? Joseph was the son of what was supposed to have been Jacob's original wife, Rachel. So he was seen, as Jacob looked forward, as the logical one to inherit the family operation and to oversee it. Now, this would have been quite unusual in some respects because Joseph was among the youngest of the children in the family. At this point, he was next to the baby, apparently. It seems apparent that it may be that all of the other brothers, with the exception of Benjamin, were older than Joseph. That might not have been the case with one or two others, but he was among the youngest. Certainly quite a bit younger probably than Reuben, who was the oldest, the firstborn from the wife Leah. So what we have here is Joseph in a position of responsibility over that of his brothers. Joseph was 17 and was feeding the flock. And he was with the lads, or the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, the sons of Zilpah, his father's wife. And the end of verse 2, Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, I don't think we ought to look at this as tattling. I think what's happening here is Joseph, as a 17-year-old, was responsible for the operation. And the slaves' sons were to be doing the job that Joseph directed them to do. He was overseeing the operation. The other sons were supposed to be doing a lot of the work. So Joseph comes to give Dad an update on how the family business is doing. And in essence, he comes and says, those four guys are lazy so-and-sos. Now, I don't know what exactly Joseph said, but he brought a bad report. Now, none of it says that the bad report was untrue. It apparently was the case. These four young men were not working very hard, apparently, or weren't very diligent, weren't leading the flocks to proper pastures. Whatever the story might have been, it was a bad report. So maybe they didn't oversee things the way they should. Maybe they were irresponsible in their carrying out of the care for the flocks. Nonetheless, it was a bad report. Now, we don't know whether Joseph said foolish things, said harsh things, said things that were offensive, or whether they simply were as accurate as could be. Point is, we can learn that there are times in our lives, and we likewise are responsible for whatever it might be. It might be something at work, it might be something in the family, it might be something in the church, it might be something in the neighborhood, etc. We are responsible. And when we are responsible, correction may need to be given. Correction that is not given harms the situation, does not improve it, in fact, hurts it in the long run. Correction that is given improperly, likewise, complicates and causes greater problems. So what we want to strive to do is correct with wisdom. Now we'll pause there for a moment. Again, you might grab your 3x5 card from your front of the Bible and stick it in here at Genesis 37. I'd like you to turn with me, we'll come back here in a moment, to Proverbs 26. Proverbs 26. Pretty typically there are two challenges with correction. One is, I don't want to do it. The other is doing it too harshly. I don't do it at all, or I do it too harshly. Now, there is a third problem, and that is trying to sort out, is it my responsibility to give correction? And that's why we turn to Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 17. Before we give correction, we must be sure that it is our responsibility to give that correction. Proverbs 26 and verse 17 says this, "He who passes by and meddles in a quarrel not his own is like one who takes a dog by the ears." Now, I don't know how many of you have had dogs, but if you walk up to a dog and grab its ear and give it a good yank or twist, what is that dog likely to do? It's likely to bite you as quickly as it can get its fangs into you. You don't just grab a dog and yank its ear. Well, in essence, to get involved with something that's not our responsibility, a quarrel, as it says here, that is not his own, is like just grabbing a dog and yanking it by the ears. Ears are very sensitive on a dog, and you mess with those ears and you're going to get bit along the way. So probably one of the challenges, greatest challenges with correction is sorting out, is it my responsibility to give this correction? And then if it is, we ask God for the wisdom to understand the correct weight of correction that needs to be given. Do we need to be harsh? Do we need to be gentle? I think a general rule of thumb is begin gently and increase if the situation warrants it. Begin gently and increase pressure if the situation warrants it. Again, we pray for wisdom, things that we are responsible for. Take care and caution when correcting. Things that are not our responsibility, take even a greater deal of care and caution along the way. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 37. We cannot shy away from correction, but neither should we be harsh if it is uncalled for. Genesis 37, again, in the first two verses, Joseph is given responsibility. He comes back to his father and gives a report, a bad report. Maybe that report was justified. Maybe it was not. Maybe Joseph, as an idealistic 17-year-old, was a little bit over the top, too enthusiastic, taking that reins of responsibility a little further than he should have. We're not told. But if I were a betting man, looking at Joseph's life as a whole, looking at his ability, my guess is he nailed it on the head. That the boys were being irresponsible. They were not carrying out their jobs properly. Now again, you can ask why. We don't know. But think of yourself as the son of a slave. Why should I kill myself over the old man's flocks when I'm not going to benefit from it anyway? Somebody else is going to get it all. And that somebody else is the legitimate son from the legitimate wife. Maybe that was their attitude. But whatever it was, a deep hatred began to develop toward Joseph, I should say, by the other sons. Back to Genesis chapter 37 in verse 3. Principle number 2, I think we can glean from the story of Jacob, is favoritism yields bad fruit. Favoritism yields bad fruit, and is a parenting responsibility. We understand that favoritism among our children, if we show favoritism, we probably cause ourselves and the family some grave difficulty. Now, I would put a sub-point immediately under this, because in one sense we say favoritism yields bad fruit, but also jealousy is a canker. Or we could say a cancer. We could say, in one sense, as we read through this, that favoritism was the problem. But I would submit to you that jealousy was as much of, if not more, of the problem. Genesis 37, verse 3. Now Israel, that's Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. We'll pause there for a moment. I'm sure none of you have ever experienced or seen anything like that. How many times have we heard, oh, the baby of the family gets such special treatment? My older siblings have mentioned things about myself and my younger brother. We're the tail end. They were the start. Well, when we were at home, we weren't allowed to. We didn't get away with it. And we say, yeah, sure. Selective recall is what I mentioned at that point. But it is often true, is it not? How about if it's a child of your very old age? Do we then show favoritism, this beautiful thing? Now, again, there's a situation in our culture that's becoming, in many senses, much more common. That's grandparents raising grandchildren. And again, there's this special love between grandparents and grandchildren. Joseph was fairly young when Jacob was fairly old. And again, you get to the tail end, you've learned a lot by raising other children. You do things differently sometimes when they get to be younger. But he was his favorite. He loved him more than all his children. Now, because he was the son of his old age. He was also the son of the original wife. Remember, Jacob worked for 7 years to marry Rachel, this beautiful doe-eyed woman that he had so fallen in love with. And then on the wedding night, his father-in-law apparently got him quite tipsy, and he ended up with the older daughter, Leah. Jacob works another 7 years to marry Rachel. Now he has two wives, and he increases his problems, of course, by marrying the slaves, as we said, having children with them as well. But nonetheless, this son, he was a child of his old age. In essence, Joseph was the firstborn of his favorite wife, his legitimate wife, we might say. Maybe, in addition, Jacob loved Joseph because Joseph showed such great promise, talents, abilities, personality. Maybe Joseph was a particularly amiable person. You've met people like that that are just sharp. No matter what they put their hand to, they just are good at it. They've got talents and abilities coming out their ears, we might say. And add that, an amiable personality, it's a hard thing to beat. Joseph seemed to have all those things, possibly. Maybe it was clear that Joseph was already being selected to take over the family business. Jacob loved him most of all. And, the rest of verse 3, he also made him a tunic of many colors. Some say many pieces. Remember, someone once told me that they thought this would be like a Scottish plaid. And I always wondered why they told me that, because I can never find anything that backs that by any stretch of the imagination. But some have talked about these pieces, many pieces, these strips of colored cloth that were put together. Nonetheless, it was something very special. It may have been a symbol of the one who would inherit all that was Jacob's. Maybe not, but nonetheless, it was a very special symbol between Jacob and Joseph, and Joseph wore it with apparently some relish, maybe even pride. Verse 4, the coat, of course, enraged the brothers. When his brothers saw, in other words, with behavior and with this special garment, when the brothers saw their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So we as parents understand showing favoritism is probably not going to help our family unity. It's hard sometimes not to show preference. Some of you have had multiple children, many children. You'll find, of course, that some of them are just easier kids. They're more amiable, they're more pliable, they're more resilient. Others are just harder to get along with, harder to deal with. It's just the way things are. So it's hard sometimes not to show preference, or in some cases even favoritism. If you have more than one child, at some point, one or the other or both children will accuse the other of being treated specially, being given special treatment. Tommy Smothers, right? The old Smothers Brothers routine. Mom always loved you best. It's the same routine. It always happens. Somehow it comes up. Maybe it's perceived. Maybe it's real. It's hard not to show favoritism, but wise parents strive to the best of their ability not to show favoritism, but to help each of our children develop their talents, their abilities to their utmost, to love them the same. And that requires individual attention. It requires a lot of work. Sometimes it requires prayer. Every parent has likely been in a situation from time to time where, look, I just don't like my kid. what are you doing? Why are you? I didn't raise you this way. What's wrong with you? So sometimes it's even hard to like the children. And again, there are some children that are just difficult. They just are. And I'm not looking at it. I try not to look out when I say that. But some of us are just difficult. Some are more amiable. Some are more pliable. It's just the way it is. When they saw Joseph, though, they could not even speak a kind word about him. Now, it may be that Joseph did not help the situation. Maybe he was completely unaware of their feelings. Maybe as a young 17-year-old, he thought this attention was proper because he did have the abilities to take over the business when the time was right, and the other brothers didn't. He had insights that they didn't, possibly. So maybe he fueled the fire, maybe he didn't, we're not told. But it certainly seems that he didn't quite get the level of anger that had been building up in his brothers. No doubt favoritism yielded bad fruit, but likewise, jealousy is a cancer. And they were jealous of Joseph. Had they properly analyzed the situation, as I believe Reuben did, we'll see that in a few minutes, they would have seen, you know what? Joseph is the logical choice. This kid is sharp. This kid is insightful. This kid has ideas I would never even think of to improve the business, to take care of things, to make things right, to make money. This kid knows how to do it. And to be able to recognize that and allow that to develop takes special insight, takes sometimes God's Spirit. John the Baptist saw that. John the Baptist was an amazing teacher. He was an inspirational speaker. Thousands were following him. And when he saw Christ, what did he say? I must decrease, he must increase. It wasn't a personal thing. It's obvious what God was doing. So he was willing to turn over everything to Christ. And he did so. Leads us to lesson number three, or principle number three, that we can glean from the story of Joseph. And that is, God truly does direct our lives. If we yield to God, God truly does yield. He does direct our lives. He directs them. He guides them. We can trust him to do that. Genesis 37 and verse 5. Now Joseph had a dream. Unusual. We're not told that any of the other brothers had a dream. Now, did they dream at night? Well, of course. Here and there. But this was not just a dream. This was a supernatural event. And Joseph recognized that. Others would later come to recognize that. Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers. Again, here's where I say I don't think he really grasped what he was doing and how he was maybe aggravating the situation. Had a dream and told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, in other words, they didn't have dreams like this. This was, God was doing something special, and they did not grasp it. They resented it. Verse 6, so he said to them, please hear the dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Those who live in Amish country have seen sheaves standing in the field. You basically take a knife and you cut the bottom of the stalks and you bundle them together. You tie them in the bundle while you put them out so they dry. And they're easy to pick up afterwards. And you bring them in for threshing, etc., etc. But there we were, binding sheaves in the field, binding up these stalks of grain. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. I don't think Joseph was saying this in any kind of haughty attitude. This is the story. What do you think this all means? That's just kind of amazing to me. Now, my guess is the brothers pretty much grasped what it meant. But this kid is sharp. I mean, you know that, don't you? You're working with somebody and they're just good. They just know their stuff. They're talented at this. And sometimes Satan can inspire jealousy. That instead of glorying in what God has given this person, the skills and abilities, there's a jealousy that I want that. I wish I had that. Or in some cases like this, I'm going to put that down because I don't have it. God was already looking ahead several decades and giving Joseph dreams that predicted the future. And the brothers may have grasped that, but nonetheless they resented it. So verse 8, the brothers said to him, "Shall you indeed reign over us?" What's the answer to that question? Yes. They didn't like the idea. Anyone have an older, or I should say a younger brother or sister that was just a talented kid? You think that little brat? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? The answer is yes. That's what God was giving by the dream. So how do we help that? No, they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. It made them very angry. But God was directing all of this. Because what would he do? He would eventually place Joseph in a position that he would be over, reigning over his brothers, having dominion over them, but not for a bad reason, for a very good reason, to spare their lives, to save them. Christ is over us, not because he wants us under his thumb, but he wants to save us. Verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream, and probably mistake, told it to his brothers. Now maybe it's again out of enthusiasm. This is amazing. This is like a vision. It's not just like a dream after eating, you know, hot dogs and pickles and not sleeping well. This is a real vision in one sense. He told to his brothers and said, "Look, I dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me." Wow. I'll bet they didn't appreciate that dream any more than the previous one. But now this kid seems to be getting a little haughty. Who is the sun and the moon? So, verse 10, he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have dreamed?" Now, he didn't dream it. God gave it to him. "Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you?" What was the answer to that question? Yes. They didn't know that was the answer yet, but yes, that's what God was intending. That Joseph would be in a position that his entire family would bow down to him and his responsibility. Show honor to him in that regard. Verse 11, his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. In other words, Dad saw what God was doing with Joseph, saw his abilities, saw his talents, saw that he was head and shoulders above any of his brothers in his abilities, and filed this away. Saying there's something to this. It's not an ordinary dream. This is not an ordinary kid, young man. There's something special here. He didn't particularly like the idea on one hand, but he realized there was something to it. Hold your place here. Tom, turn to Psalm 37. Psalm 37. What was God doing through these dreams? He was predicting the future. He was giving insight into the future. God was directing the entire event. And he gave Joseph dreams, primarily, I would suspect, for encouragement. Because it would be a long time before these dreams would come true. Before they would come to fruition. Before they'd be acted out. A few decades, actually. So these dreams, these very vivid pictures that God gave to Joseph, would be of great encouragement later on and help sustain him during what were some very dark years in Joseph's life. They would not make total sense until they were fulfilled, but knowing that God had communicated through these dreams to Joseph would have been very important to him, would have been very encouraging to him. Psalm 37 and verse 23. "The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord." They're ordered by the Lord. Some translations read, "The steps of a good man are directed by the Lord." Another translation, "The steps of a good man are established by the Lord." and he delights in his way. If he shall fall, he'll not be utterly cast down, for the Lord upholds him with his hand. Now, we could read more. That's all we'll read for now. But God does direct the steps. He does order the steps. He does establish the steps of the righteous. And you are in that category. God is directing your life. If we're yielded to him, he will direct us. Turn over to Proverbs chapter 3. Proverbs chapter 3. Remember, this was one of the very first scriptures that I marked in my Bible. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5. I went to Ambassador College as a 17-year-old and bought my first Bible at the Ambassador College bookstore. I wanted a nice, big, wide-margin Bible on both sides, but I couldn't afford that, so I only got a wide margin on the outside. So all my notes in my original Bible are very tiny on the inside margin, but very large on the outside margin. Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not to your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths." I think Joseph was that kind of man. He was acknowledging God. He knew these dreams were special from God, and he did trust God to direct his steps. We will face similar situations to Joseph from time to time. We might face jealousy of others. We might face hardship. We might face sickness. We might face obstacles. God promises that he will direct our lives. He will guide our steps. He will establish those steps if we're faithful to him. God was directing this entire operation. Turn back to Genesis 37. We'll continue on to a fourth principle. A fourth truism we learn from the life of Joseph is this: God overrules man. God overrules man. God had a direction that his plan was being led, was being guided, and he would not let the pettiness of human beings derail that or change that. Genesis 37 and verse 12. "Then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem." Now, what's the first question you ask? Israel said to Joseph, what question would you ask? Why isn't Joseph in the field with his brothers? What does it take to feed flocks? It doesn't take a lot of ability necessarily. Sure, you need to know when to change areas and locations to provide enough grazing for them, but it doesn't take a lot. But if you're at home running the family business and you're going out then as an administrator, you get more of a sense of apparently what Joseph was involved with. He'd already been out feeding flocks. It's not that he couldn't do it. Earlier in the chapter, we told he was out with his four other brothers, already feeding the flocks. It's not that he couldn't do it. Not that he had better or bigger responsibilities likely to take care of. His father is sending him as an administrator. I want you to go out and see how we're doing. How many flock we have. How many kids have been born. Let's see how things are rolling along. His brothers went to feed the flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." So he said to him, "Here I am, Dad, whatever you ask." Joseph was not sitting at home twiddling his thumbs as a teenager. He was helping run the family business. So verse 14, he said to him, Jacob to Joseph, "Please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me." So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. So this would be up in the hill country where his brothers would now be grazing the flocks in these various areas. He hadn't heard from them for a while, so Jacob sends Joseph to find out what's going on. Verse 15. "Now a certain man found him, and there he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, 'What are you seeking?'" So he kind of takes note of this young man going up hills and dales trying to find where his brother's flocks might be. What are you seeking? And he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they've departed from here. They changed pasture. They departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. Now, it's interesting that Dothan was apparently a city as well as a region. So they wanted apparently to feed the flocks fairly close to the populated areas. Who knows what the reasons for that were, but nonetheless, there they were feeding the flocks. Verse 18, they saw him afar off, even before he came near them. How did they know it was him? Probably was wearing that fancy coat that made them so mad. They could see it was him way off. But they conspired against him to kill him. That's how bad it had gotten. That's how deep the jealousy had become. Now again, maybe Joseph didn't do his part very well to help allay that jealousy. But nonetheless, here they're all out in the field, and Mr. Special stays home and does the accounting work, or does the book work, or does the planning work, or decides what's going to be happening next. He's already taking responsibility over his brothers, and they let jealousy and envy drive them to the point that they want to kill him. Verse 19, they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him, cast him into some pit, and we'll say some wild beast has devoured him. We'll see what will become of his dreams. Don't think so. God overrules man. Reuben heard it. Now, my guess is, and again, I'm planting things in Reuben's head here in the story that may or may not have been there, but I think Reuben saw what Joseph was like, what his talents and abilities really were. And he realized that, look, this kid is going to be the heir. This guy knows what he's doing. He is sharp as a tack. He's intelligent. He's got a great personality. He's got it all. Can't just kill the kid. Reuben heard it. He delivered him out of their hands. He grabbed him, apparently. Said, let us not kill him. Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into the pit. Cast him into the pit, which is in the wilderness. And do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. What was his plan? Let's grab the kid, throw him in the pit. After this kind of night goes by, I'll go grab the kid and take him back home. Can't just kill your brother. Can't kill this kid. God overrules man. Their intent was to kill Joseph, but God intervenes through Reuben to prevent his death, spared his life. We can trust that God will overrule humans in our lives when necessary. There are those who hate us, who want to kill us, who want to steal from us, who want to take from us. We can trust that God overrules man. God is our rock. He is our salvation. Can give us a fifth principle. God often accomplishes good from evil. God often accomplishes good from evil. In verse 23, evil still sets in on Joseph. As we read in verse 21, Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, said, let's not kill him. He said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness. Do not lay a hand on him. And we're just going to let him die in the pit, but then you don't have blood on your hands, at least literal blood. You still have proverbial blood, but not literal blood. And his intent was to deliver him out of their hands, bring him back to his father. Verse 23. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic, that coat that they hated so much, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. So it was a dry well. So who knows how deep it would have been dug. But obviously Joseph could not get out on his own. Verse 25, rather calloused individuals, they sat down to eat a meal. So they just threw their brother in a pit and intended to leave him there to die and sit down for dinner. Didn't seem to affect them. Then they lifted their eyes and looked. And there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So this trading caravan is on its way by. Judah says to his brothers, and we've often mused that it was Judah who figured out how to make some money out of this situation. There's a talent among those people to make money. There just is. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Verse 27, come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. We can't kill him. We can't let him starve or die out there of thirst beyond our shoulders somehow. So let's just sell him into slavery, make some money on this. And his brothers listened. His brothers listened. This event by Judah would cause him no end of guilt. Decades later, things that happened to the brothers, Judah attributed to the fact that they sold their brother into slavery. You cannot not have consequences for these kinds of sins. They will come back to haunt us. We know that. His brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Talk about evil. Brothers selling their youngest and probably most talented brother into slavery. We might say for a measly 20 bucks. What they intended for evil would eventually bring good. God often accomplishes good right out of evil. We can trust him with that. What happened to Joseph was evil. The concept to remember is eventually. Sometimes evil does stalk Christians. Satan is a being who hates us, would love to see us destroyed. Joseph, in one sense, is a picture of a righteous individual who is being persecuted by others, who is being given a hard time. Evil is done to him, and it's allowed to be done to him, but for the purpose of eventually bringing good. When evil is done to you, trust that God will eventually work good from it. That he knows exactly what's going on. He is not asleep. He is allowing it for good in the long run. And again, the word is eventually. Leads us to another principle. Principle number 6 we can learn from Joseph's story. Lying is never blessed. Lying, in this case to cover sin, will not be blessed. Lying is always wrong. It is always harmful. It is always against the commandments. And yet that's exactly what the brothers tried to do. They tried to cover this sin with lies. And it's like putting Band-Aid over an infected cut. You can cover up that infection, but it still bubbles underneath and eventually breaks out. Genesis 37 in verse 29. Reuben then returned to the pit. And indeed, Joseph was not in the pit. Now, Reuben was not a part of selling Joseph into slavery. What was his intention? Why did he go back to the pit? He was going to get Joseph and take him back to Dad. Start the trip back, send him back, whatever needed to be necessary. It may have been that he would just send him on his way. And then when the brothers came back to the pit and Joseph was gone, he must have escaped. Don't know what Reuben was going to say, whether he was going to take him back personally, send him back on his own. But nonetheless, he comes to the pit and he's gone. He tore his clothes. Couldn't believe this was happening. And he returned to his brothers. So maybe Reuben had gone into town to buy supplies and now is on his way back and he finds Joseph is gone. He returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more. And where shall I go? whom would Jacob hold responsible? Any of you firstborn in your family? One, a couple. If you've had younger siblings, who's in charge when mom and dad are gone? In our family, my sister was the oldest, and then four boys. So we occasionally visit my sister in the mental institution these days. No, I'm kidding. It wasn't that bad, but we did not make it easy on my sister when mom and dad were not there. Unfortunately, she's forgiven us for those things over the years. But Reuben was responsible. He's the oldest. Who's dad going to ask? Reuben, what did you do? What did you allow these guys? What's going on? Where's my son? Where's Joseph? Reuben knew he would have to report on what had gone on. So he says, the lad is gone. Where shall I go? So, verse 31, they took Joseph's tunic, killed the kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father. Now, when it says they sent the tunic of many colors, brought it to their father, seems like they shipped it first. So, it was UPS via camel. Sends it back to dad first, kind of wants that to hit first before they walk in necessarily. Now, maybe they brought it themselves. But maybe it was a note that was with them. And anyway, it says, we found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not? Like everybody knew exactly what that coat looked like and exactly who it was. So they kind of send it and said, well, is this Joseph's? Verse 33, and he recognized it. Of course he did. He had it made specially for his son and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Interesting. They would have been able to say, we didn't tell him that. We never said we found Joseph dead. We never lied. What were they doing? You see, some people justify that. They justify deceiving others by saying, well, I didn't actually say that. I just let them come to the conclusion on their own. Well, the point is, if we are deceiving others, it is sin. Whether or not we directly lie, we are an instrument of deception. God shows over and over through examples like these that that's just wrong. You don't deceive others intentionally. When someone says, hey, you got your Christmas shopping done? We don't say, oh yeah, I did lots of my, I'm way done with that. Well, what are we implying? We're implying that we do Christmas shopping when we don't. How much better to say, well, I'm a Christian who doesn't keep Christmas, so I don't have to worry about all that gift shopping stuff. You know what they'll usually say? Oh, man, I wish I was that way. It's such a hassle this time of year, all these people, all this crowd, oh, terrible. You don't hear anyone say, I just love the Christmas. I love going to all these stores and buying all the gifts and having to park 3 miles away from the store and walk in here in the middle of this miserable weather to do all this. It's so much fun. Does anyone ever say that? You ever heard anyone say, I love Christmas shopping? They don't. They hate it. So why would we be worried? We say, well, I don't do it. I don't do this. I'm a Christian who doesn't keep Christmas. Now, they just don't know what to say. Occasionally, there'll be someone who will kind of look at you like you've got four eyes and a horn sticking out of your head. But most time, it's not even an issue. Oh, man, you're the lucky one. You don't have to go through all this stuff. How many times have we heard that? Oh, man, I wish that was me. Well, it could be. It could be. So they implied that Joseph had been killed. And they could say, probably later on, well, we didn't lie to him. He came up with that all on his own. But no, you deliberately deceived him. You set it up so that he would deliberately come to the wrong conclusion. That's what you intended. That is deception. That's wrong. So Joseph was dead in Jacob's eyes. Verse 34, Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. So for a few decades, these boys would live with this secret. Verse 35. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. Those sons. Pretty hypocritical, wasn't it? Pretty hypocritical. But he refused to be comforted, and he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. This was, yes, his favorite son, the son of his old age. Maybe he did receive more attention than he should have. But he was an extremely talented young man. And to have lost that companionship, that talent, that ability, would have been very, very difficult for an old man. Now, verse 36, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. Turn, if you would, to Numbers chapter 32. Numbers chapter 32. This may be a scripture that you've memorized. Numbers 32:23. Take Numbers 32, reverse the two numbers, you have verse 23. Tremendous spiritual principle. Numbers 32, verse 23. But if you do not do so, then take note. Pause for a moment. Moses was addressing the children of Israel. Some of the tribes inherited land on the east side of the Jordan. Most of the enemies lived on the west side of the Jordan. So there was a challenge here. The guys who are settling on the east said, "We'll just go settle down and stay over here." And Moses is saying, "Well, no, 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 no. You can't just stay here because your brothers need help taking over their areas on the other side of the Jordan." So they make an agreement. And the tribes who are going to settle on the west say, "Look, we'll settle here, but we promise we'll always aid the people on the east who need our help." So pretty good arrangement. So Moses is now, in essence, making them promise to do so. "If you do not do so, then take note, you have sinned against the Eternal. And here's the principle, and be sure your sin will find you out." Sin that is hidden and unrepented of will always come out at some point. At some point. You can't hide sin. Like we said, that infection will break out. It will become obvious. Now, we're very thankful that repented sin can be erased. And many things that we repent of are between us and God. And they're erased and they're gone. God doesn't say, "If you sin and then repent, too bad, your sin will find you out. I'm going to expose that." It's not necessary. If it's repented of, it's repented of. God doesn't have to expose it. But if it's unrepented of, God almost has to expose it because He loves us and wants us to improve. So it's not to spite us. It's not to threaten us. It's because He wants us to improve, wants us to change. So lying to cover sin will never be blessed, will never be good. Deception is not something of God's character. It's not something He wants us to do. He wants us to be pure. Lying to cover sin will not work. Now we come to the end of chapter 37. And Joseph has been sold into slavery under the hand of Potiphar. It says Potiphar was the captain of the guard. He was an officer of Pharaoh. There's lots of different ways to interpret that. Many feel, when it says captain of the guard, that he was responsible for Pharaoh's personal protection. He was the one who was responsible to keep the palace safe, to keep the Pharaoh and his family safe. The color guard, we might say, of the palace. Others render this the chief of the executioners. He was the one that would carry out the sentencing and the death or execution or imprisonment of anyone who moved against Pharaoh. Either way, he was a very important person. He was a very responsible individual, very close to the Pharaoh and his family. with a great deal of responsibility. So isn't it interesting when we said earlier that God will accomplish good from evil? Here is Joseph sold into slavery. He could have been sold to anybody. But he's purchased by one of the leading individuals in the entire nation. Is God watching out for Joseph? You bet he is. He's not going to be treading out grain in the mud fields. He's not going to be hauling rocks to build the pyramids. He's working underneath one of the most responsible individuals in the entire nation. So God placed him in a position to do him good and to do his family, by extension, good as well, as we'll see next time. So at this point, we've reached right at an hour. So we're going to pause here and pick it up with part two next time. We'll skip chapter 38 because chapter 38 is an inset chapter in the story. Chapter 38 hits the pause button, pulls us away from the story of Joseph, and takes us to the story of Judah. Now, that story about Judah is an entirely interesting one for a different reason. But then chapter 39 takes the pause button off, and we're back to the story of Joseph again. So next time we'll pick up the story and the life of Joseph and what we can learn from it in Genesis chapter 39.